This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
I'm Morgan.
And I'm Sarah.
And this week, we are on episode 67, where we are covering Betty Broderick.
And she was just a hot-ass mess.
Yeah, I mean,
that's my summary of her.
That is a good summary. The whole thing is a hot mess. And really just like the epitome of a messy marriage.
Exactly.
Messy divorce, rather. Yeah, you've probably heard of her before. She is rather famous for this crime. But before we get into that today, what are you binging, Sarah?
So I've started getting into these weird dramatic history shows.
Okay.
And
like a historical drama?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
As thanks to my fiance, because he just starts watching them and I'm like, I'm not going to be interested in this.
Yeah.
And then I sit on the couch and I can't stop watching.
Right.
So lately we've been watching this show on Netflix called The Tudors.
Okay.
And it's basically about Henry VIII.
Yeah.
And like a dramatization mm-hmm. of all of his wives and all the crazy shit that he did, and like the Tudors obviously are in it, and Boleyn, and it's just like, it's terrible, but I can't stop watching it.
Yeah.
And like, there's only four seasons, and it only ran from 2007 to 2011.
Okay.
I think it ran on Showtime, but now it's on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, it's kind of like, what was the last show like this that I watched, the Viking show?
Yeah.
The Last Kingdom, where it's just like all sex and action.
Right.
Basically.
Nice.
And so that's what this is.
And you've never watched Game of Thrones?
No, I haven't.
Sarah, God damn it.
I know. It's just such a commitment.
Yeah, but it's like, I mean, it's mostly, like, the first two seasons rely heavily on the sex.
Okay.
But, yeah, it's good.
I get it.
I'm sorry, I just interrupted your binge to force you to watch Game of Thrones.
It honestly needs to happen really bad.
I think you'll like it. It's not that big of a time commitment. Like, I mean, it is, but
it's only 90 hours of a
time. Me, when I'm like, I've consumed Critical Role twice.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's not great, but it's not bad.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting, and it's pretty historically accurate. Like, I know a lot about the history.
Yeah.
And my fiance was watching it, and he was like, do you think they're gonna behead her? And I was like, oh boy, you
win for a surprise.
You remember how he beheaded six of his wives? Like,
10 out of 10.
Yeah. But that is my binge
nice.
This week. What is your binge, Morgan?
My binge, as per usual, is gonna be something nerdy.
Okay.
So I have started watching a new TTRPG.
What the fuck is that?
It's tabletop role-playing game. So
okay.
Like Dungeons and Dragons, but it is a different set of rules. So it's called Into the Motherlands, and it's like premiering on Twitch on the Cipher of Tear channel. I'm saying a lot of words right now, I'm very sorry. But it's super, super fun. They're not using, like, D&D rule sets for their universe. But it's essentially, like, they just started. They've only done three episodes. The first episode was them, like, all building their characters live. And then the other two are, like, their first two runs of it. And they're basically, like, building their entire own universe. And it's being described as, instead of a soap opera, a space opera, which I fucking love because I'm so lame. But it's fucking great so far, and it's an entirely Black and POC cast.
Oh,
and
wow.
So they're like, they're bringing color to the world of tabletop gaming because everyone can play it and everyone does play. But there's often like a lack of representation. So it's really cool. They're like building all of their like races and cultures and things like that, like based in like American history and like Black culture, but turning it to like fit into the space world.
That's awesome.
And it's really fun and it's really special, and it feels like I'm watching like something from the beginning, you know? Yeah. Like it feels like it's gonna be like on par with Critical Role, so I'm just very excited for it. It does premiere on Sundays when I play my own D&D game, so I haven't been able to watch it live, but I watch it later on Twitch on the VOD.
See?
Yeah. So it's super fun. And I said a lot of words at the beginning.
You did.
It's called Into the Motherlands. Okay. I don't know how much of a cross-section there are of true crime lovers and Dungeons & Dragons nerds.
I bet there's a lot, honestly.
I feel like there has to be. But if you're interested, check it out on Twitch. In Cypher of Tyr is C-Y-P-H-E-R of T-Y-R.
Oh.
Yes, because those names are always spelled crazy, so I had to look it up beforehand because I was like, I don't remember how the fucking thing is spelled. But yeah, it's super fucking cool. I like it a lot, and a lot, like, all of the people who are on it are, like, very good at creating their characters.
That's
and, like,
good.
It's just, it's very fun. I like it a lot. I've talked too much about it, but
that sounds awesome.
It was very fun. It was very fun.
So,
yes.
You can leave this in if you want.
I did not mean to. Yes. Okay.
I downloaded Among Us.
Okay. Okay.
And I played the free play thing for about 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then Corey told me if I played it, he would divorce me.
10 out of 10.
And I also did not understand anything.
Yeah.
So I haven't picked it back up. And then I immediately afterwards watched Colleen's video her not being able to play. And I was like, I feel like I could do better than this, but I haven't tried again.
Yeah. I am not very good at it either. It gives me too much anxiety knowing that there's other people on their phone at home also playing for some reason. It just makes me feel very uncomfy. And I finally got to be the imposter and I literally exited out of the game. Which is such a dick move, but I got so panicked. I left, closed out of the app, and was like, Among Us is not for me.
But, like, I get it. I would much rather play with computers than with real-life people. Because even though they don't know you, they will still judge you.
They're judging me.
Yeah, I don't want to be judged.
I feel that. That actually kind of plays off of something I wanted to say, kind of. But today I had therapy, and I was talking about how, like, I often get so caught up in, like, being misunderstood in what I'm trying to say to people that I often say, like, the wrong thing anyway, and, like, things like that, essentially. Just being, like, afraid of talking because I might say the wrong thing and things like that.
Me constantly.
Yeah, and I'm gonna look it up because Susie said this to me, and I just thought it was really nice. And I was also talking about how, like, I don't like going out in public. One, just I don't like going out in public. But two, like, I always, worst case scenario, you know, like, in my head. So if I go out alone, someone might talk to me.
Yes.
And God forbid someone fucking talk to me. It's horrifying.
Every time I go to the grocery store, I make sure I have headphones in with the cord so people know not to talk to me.
Yeah. And she was like, well, your voice is your first line of defense, so you should be using it. It's there to protect you. And I don't know why, but when she said that, it made me tear up. Aww. And I was like, maybe someone else needs to hear it. Like, it's just one of those, like, it's a throwaway sentence. It probably wasn't supposed to be profound, you know? But, like, I don't know. It was just really nice, and I liked it. And I'm sharing it because feelings.
It's true. Like, I mean, in a group of people, I'm the same way. Like, I'm not the person to talk.
Yeah.
Like, I am always talked over, and I just accept it or walk away. Like, I don't try and defend myself when that happens. And so you're 100% right.
Yeah.
Susie's 100% right.
Yeah, love Susie. I fucking love Susie too. She's great. But enough about us and mostly me just saying a bunch of words.
About
that's what a podcast is, realistically, is us saying a bunch of words. So I guess that's kind of what you're here for, but you're mostly here about true crime.
We're basically on par.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So let's see. Should we just get into it?
Let's talk about Let's talk about Betty Broderick.
All right. So, she was born as Elizabeth Ann Biscellia on November 7th, 1947, to parents Marita and Frank Biscellia. Her father was an Italian-American and her mother was an Irish-American. In total, the couple would have six children and Elizabeth was the third. Growing up in Eastchester, New York, her family were devout Roman Catholics and, in turn, pretty strict parents. Betty would say that she was raised to be a housewife from the moment she was born and was expected to marry a nice Catholic man. She said she was told, go to Catholic schools, be careful with dating until you find a Catholic man, support him while he works, be blessed in your later years with grandchildren. Which is just like...
your typical, like, you know, 50s housewife.
Yeah, that was kind of how women were viewed at that time in general. She would go on to graduate from Maria Regina High School in 1965 and then attended the College of Mount St. Vincent in the Bronx at the age of 17. She earned a degree here in early childhood education and also got a minor in English. Okay, just at me next time. I'm just kidding. That's what I started as. During her first year of college, she traveled to see a football game with her friend at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Is it Notre Dame or Notre Dame, you know?
I say Notre Dame, mm-hmm. and, like, I'm whenever sure... I watch football, that's what they say.
Okay, all right. So,
but, like, from New York to Indiana, that's kind of a long drive, like, yeah, for a that trip.
Is for, like, a football game. For yeah. But good for you. And at this game, she actually met Dan Broderick. And he was a senior at the school at the time. Apparently, they met at a party after the game where Dan introduced himself by writing on a napkin, Daniel T. Broderick III, MDA.
And Morgan, what does MDA stand for?
Well, it stands for medical doctor almost, which is the fucking worst joke I've ever heard.
I mean, it probably worked.
Yeah, it was probably very cute at the time. Like, ooh, you know.
Yeah, especially, like, she's, you know, a freshman just yeah. getting into college. She's like, I'm going on to med school.
Yeah. Like, yeah, for sure. But also, it's cheesy, Dan. Dan was not like the typical guys that she had dated. She was used to dating football players, and Dan was more of the tall, skinny, nerdy type. After this, they began dating, and he started telling his friends that he was going to marry Betty someday, and they dated for the next 3 years. After graduating from Notre Dame, he went to Cornell Medical College, so just one nice school to another.
Oh, yeah. He's got to be smart as fuck, you know?
Yeah, or have money. But that was rude to people who get into those schools. But everyone knows if you have money, you can get into a nice school. Yeah. Let's see. He would travel back and forth to her home from Cornell just to see her regularly. So they were doing, like, the long distance thing, and they were doing it well. She would sometimes even accompany him back on his trips to Pittsburgh to spend time with his family. And similarly to her, Daniel had a large Irish Catholic family, and he was the oldest of nine children. So everything's fallen into place, you know?
Yeah, it's supposed to be the perfect life.
Yeah. Dan obsessed over Betty and treated her like a queen, practically asking her to marry him every day for 3 years until she said yes. Which, let's just talk about this really quick. Stop telling men that if a woman is like, I don't want to date you, to keep pursuing, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Just leave them alone. They said no, they don't want to date you. It doesn't mean keep asking in a couple days.
I mean, she enjoyed dating him. It was the concept yeah, of marriage.
This but is different, yeah. But you know what I mean. Like, the people who are just like,
keep at it. Yeah. No, I don't want you to write hey in my Facebook Messenger once a month for the next 3 years, yeah, even after I tell you I'm dating someone.
Yeah, for sure.
Which still happens.
Yeah.
Even though I've told them I'm engaged.
People are the worst.
I got angry.
It's just, like, stop it.
So, eventually she did say yes to his proposals. And the couple got married on April 12th, 1969, at the Immaculate Conception Church in Tuckahoe, New York. And this wedding was described as just glamorous AF.
Yeah.
Their honeymoon was on a Caribbean cruise, and they stayed with some friends in St. Thomas. Betty later noted that as soon as their honeymoon was over, Dan, like, stopped courting her and just expected her to be this perfect housewife. So it, like, switched, like, it flipped like a switch.
Yeah, which I feel like, this is the difference in, like, marriage today, because, like, a lot of people are already living together beforehand, so yes. I feel like getting married is not as drastic of a change for couples like it used to be.
Yeah, definitely. Know? So, by the time they got home from their honeymoon, Betty was pregnant.
Yeah.
They were quick in that honeymoon, and their first daughter, or first child, which was a daughter, named Kim, was born in January of 1970. Betty was a really hard worker, and she would work as a third grade teacher up until the day that she gave birth.
Which is crazy.
Yes. After this, she continued to work in order to support them while Dan focused on his studies, and she also devoted herself to motherhood. And during this time, money's tight. Like, he's in school. She's not a teacher anymore because she just gave birth.
Yeah.
And so the family of three actually lived in the tiny-ass medical dorms at Cornell. Betty often stated that motherhood was her only ambition in life, so she was devoted to creating the perfect environment for her family. And this paid off eventually because soon the couple would be living the American dream.
Yes.
In July of 1971... their second child was born, another daughter, and her name was Lee. After a few months into Dan's residency, he made a career path change and now said that he wanted to be a medical malpractice attorney, saying that that's where the real money was, and he enrolled in Harvard Law School.
Yeah.
Another huge college.
Mm-hmm.
So he moved the family to Boston, Massachusetts, and devoted himself to full-time studies with the help of a student loan, while Betty took on more odd jobs and was the main provider of the family. And her neighbors often said that she could be seen selling Avon or Tupperware door-to-door with her little children following behind her.
Yeah, she was a woman on the go.
She was.
The couple went on to have three more children, Daniel in 1976, Rhett in 1979, and another son who unfortunately died just a few days after being born.
And I don't think he was ever given a name either.
Yeah. After law school, Dan quickly found a job at a high-end law firm in San Diego, so the family moved to California. Even though Dan was making more money now, Betty continued working part-time while caring for the children. It took about 5 years for Dan to make enough money for Betty to stay home and not have to work. Dan started making so much money that he started calling himself Count Day Money, which is just like...
the worst thing ever.
Yeah, and it's like Count Da Money.
Yeah.
If you say it real fast.
Count Da Money.
It's just...
it's so stupid.
It's like when a serial killer gives themselves a nickname. Yes. It's just not a good time. In 1978, Dan left the law firm he was working at and started his own, which was very successful. So they bought a home in, we looked it up, technically pronounced La Jolla, but a lot of people pronounce it La Jolla or La Jolla. So don't come at us. We gave you three different fucking pronunciations. this is a very nice neighborhood, and the house that they bought here was super fucking nice, essentially, is what you're supposed to get from that. And Dan even hired a maid to help Betty around the house so she could focus on community clubs and activities, which she loved. The couple quickly became known in San Diego as socialites. They were just, like, the dream team.
Yeah, they, like, hosted big events and were always going to charity things and stuff like that.
The couple would go on shopping sprees where there was no budget, and Dan would buy himself very nice suits, expensive haircuts, and even got himself a nose job. Dan started criticizing the purchases that Betty would make, though. Like, when she would buy nice furniture or decorative pieces for the house, he would say it was unnecessary, but then would justify his spending by saying that he needed these things to look more successful for work. And I feel like this often happens with people when they, like, get super successful.
Yeah, because he's making all the money, so he wants to spend it the way he wants to.
Yeah.
Even though she put him through school.
Yeah, and I think, like, that's where, because obviously this is going to end in a murder, so I don't want to talk poorly of a victim. But in the relationship, there were definitely red flags from both parties the whole time.
And with, like, with this story, you go back and forth. You're, like, on Dan's side, on Betty's side, on Dan's, like.
Yeah, it's, like, literally every new paragraph, you're, like, it switches back to whose side you're on.
So exactly.
Right now, I'm annoyed with Dan.
Yeah. So we're going to keep being a little bit annoyed with Dan because, again, with his business booming and successful, their relationship started to fizzle out. Dan would go to work at 5 a.m. and not come home until late at night, and most nights would go out to bars after work, and he would tell Betty that he was taking clients out for business reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Betty started off not complaining about this and just, like, accepting it. But it did affect her emotionally, and it was obviously affecting their relationship. And, like, Dan also started seeing himself as the big shot guy and basically acted like the sun revolved around him.
Mm-hmm. According to Betty.
Yes. And a small, like, outside look on their marriage came from two sources later on, and their maid said that she didn't like Dan, and that he was cold and unfriendly, and that he intimidated his wife. And a neighbor, who I'm assuming was also a friend of Betty's, said that Betty's character would change every evening when it was time for Dan to come home. Betty would stop laughing and panic and run around the house, picking up all the children's stuff because she said that Dan hated to have it underfoot. When he was around, she was a completely different person. She seemed afraid of him. So that's never good.
Yeah. And at, like, it seems a lot like emotional abuse from what they were like at first. Like, he was just controlling her.
Her emotions.
Yeah. From the really, like, the start of their relationship, when you're telling your friends, like, I'm going to marry her. And then asking her constantly to marry you. And then, like, you know, like, as soon as you're home from the wedding, you have to be the housewife. And you already got a baby and you say you can't leave.
Exactly.
You
and
know?
She said that she wanted to, like, secretly leave.
Yeah.
Like, multiple times.
Yeah. And, like, in Catholicism, it's highly frowned upon.
Exactly.
And this is also, like, a time where it was still highly frowned upon in general just to get divorced without the Catholicism being involved.
Yeah. So, eventually, they started getting into arguments about money and spending and about Dan staying out late.
Yeah.
And sometimes these arguments would escalate.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm pretty sure Betty had an anger problem.
Yeah.
So, one time, Betty threw a ketchup bottle at him.
Mm-hmm.
She also threw a stereo at him.
Mm-hmm.
Another time, Dan actually got mad and threw an aquarium over the second story balcony of their home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming it had to have been, like, an empty aquarium because the aquarium's, like, 500 pounds.
Yeah.
But, like, that's too much.
Yeah, and that's, like, the thing with emotional abuse for both parties is, like, it makes you feel crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's going to make you feel insane to the point where you're so mad you're going to chuck that fucking ketchup bottle and stuff like that.
So another thing Betty would do is she also started locking Dan out of the house on the days that he would stay out late. Mm-hmm. And she would also like trash talk him to her kids and like, oh, he's out late, he doesn't love us kind of thing.
That's the one thing I highly disagree with Betty in this entire time is talking shit about Dan to your like to your children. Don't
and
do that.
They basically turn the children into a pawn.
Yeah.
And I say that in the next sentence because Dan would have to throw rocks at the children's windows to get them to open up the door. And then this started becoming a battle and they were just stuck in between this battle between their parents because Betty would get mad if they let Dan in and Dan would get mad if they didn't let them him in.
Yeah.
And also, during their arguments, like, Betty would go off and get mad and Dan would just stay quiet and ignore her. And this obviously, like, made Betty even more mad.
Yeah.
Because I'm the same way. If I'm trying to, like, fight with you, then don't ignore me.
I'm trying to elicit a reaction out of you, motherfucker, so give me the reaction.
Exactly. So, at this point, Betty's anger wasn't reserved just for Dan, but she also took it out on the kids. Their eldest daughter, Kim, later said that it was not uncommon for Betty to hit them or even, like, throw frozen food at them. One time, the second oldest daughter, Lee, who was described as very headstrong, told Betty that her spankings didn't hurt. Been there, done that. So Betty then chased Lee around the backyard, hitting her with the wire part of a fly swatter, resulting in many welts over the child's body. Kim said that when this happened, she grabbed her little brother Danny and hid in the closet because they were literally afraid.
Yeah.
Kim also said that Betty would constantly threaten to divorce Dan, asking Kim, "Who are you going to live with?" And Kim says that she secretly wished her father would divorce her mother and just take her with him.
Yeah, at that point when your mom's just, like, harassing you.
Yeah.
Yeah. At a party in 1982, Dan met a 21-year-old woman named Linda Kolkina at a party. Linda grew up in a middle-class family in Utah and had worked as an airline stewardess for Delta Airlines for a bit before being fired.
Also, I figured out why she was fired. Because she was being inappropriate with a passenger and, like, sitting on his lap and flirting with him. And all the other passengers were like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that's not professional. At the time of their meeting, Linda was working as a receptionist. Dan made a comment at this party telling one of his friends, "Isn't she beautiful?" And Betty overheard this remark and got kind of jealous, but didn't think much about it. Then Dan hired Linda as his personal assistant, even though she had no background in law. By early 1983, Betty had suspected that Dan was having an affair. Her friends told her not to think like that, but her paranoia got the best of her, and she started seeing a therapist to discuss her issues in the relationship. On Dan's 39th birthday, November 22nd, 1983, Betty went to Dan's office to surprise him with a bottle of champagne and a dozen roses. When she got to his office, Dan was not there. Yeah. So she decided to wait in his office for him. She noticed that there was a birthday cake, empty bottles of wine, two wine glasses, and balloons and other decorations already in his office. When she asked the secretary where Dan was, she told her that Dan had left around lunchtime with Linda. So Betty waited around the office for him, and while waiting, she wandered into Linda's office and noticed a photo of Dan on her desk. Which, just like, how fucking obvious are you two gonna be?
Right? Like it was a picture of him in high school. Like,
Like, just put a big old red flag on it and say, "Hey, we cheating." Like, yeah, like, I don't know.
Tattoo it on your fucking forehead, dude.
So, obviously, Betty is very upset. When the two never returned to work, Betty knew that Dan and Linda were having an affair. So Betty returned home, ran upstairs to their closet, and started ripping all of his expensive suits off the hangers, carrying them outside. She made a big pile of the thousands of dollars worth of custom tailored suits in the backyard, covered them with gasoline, lit a match, destroying the suits.
So, like, she got even. Their already rocky marriage began to deteriorate even further after this incident. Betty constantly accused her husband of cheating, and Dan constantly denied it still, saying that she was crazy and she was just imagining things. But at this point, Dan also started calling her names, and he would say that Betty was old and fat and boring and ugly and stupid and all this shit, and that, like, women were waiting in line behind her to take her place. So, like, he was taunting the fuck out of her. And Betty thought that Dan was going through, like, some sort of midlife crisis as he was going out drinking all the time. He had gotten the nose job. He bought himself a new shiny red Corvette.
Mm-hmm.
So Dan eventually moved out of their family home and got a house of his own in February of 1985, and he originally left Betty with the kids. And Betty would just drop the children off at his house one by one, thinking that Dan would finally realize how hard it was to raise the kids and maybe, like, respect her or something. And so she did this the first time on Easter Day, when Betty and Kim got into an argument, when Kim just asked Betty to drive her friend home. So Betty told Kim that all she does is take and take and take, and to pack her bags. She then dropped off Kim at Dan's house, and Dan wasn't home. But Betty just left, and Kim had to wait on the doorstep for hours until he got home. A few days later, she dropped Danny off in the same manner, and again, he had to wait on the doorstep for hours to be able to go inside. Rhett and Lee were dropped off a few months later. And so now, Dan had custody of all of the children, and he thought that this would be a nice advantage for him. Soon after this move, he admitted to having a 3-year affair, and then filed a restraining order against Betty while also filing for divorce after 16 years of marriage. And the restraining order ordered Betty to stay 100 yards away from his home, car, and office.
So this obviously led to a very nasty battle between the couple, as Betty was devastated and hurt. The court case was so lengthy and messy that it became known as one of the ugliest divorces in the United States, the Broderick versus Broderick case. Betty felt that she had an unfair chance in the divorce, as there were several lawyers in the area who would not help her due to Dan's connections. It was actually so bad that she ended up representing herself in the divorce. During the process, she hired 5 lawyers and fired all of them. She also became somewhat obsessive in her anger towards her husband, often leaving obscene messages on his answering machine and also talking poorly about Dan and Linda in phone conversations with her children. All of these outbursts would later be used against her in court, and it was said that in conversations with her children, she would mention, like, wanting to kill their father, which, don't do that.
Yeah, not great.
Like, this, I can't stress it enough. Like, no matter how much you and your spouse might hate one another, don't drag your kids into it.
Yeah.
Like, my parents were exceptional. If they were upset with each other, like, I never knew it.
That's good.
Like, they were very cordial. But growing up, I had a friend whose parents had a nasty divorce. And just, like, any time we were at one of her parents' houses, the other person would just be bitching about the other person's parent, and, like, she's just sitting there hunched over and sad. Like,
yeah.
You don't want to see your fucking parent like that. It's not, like, I don't know, just don't fucking bring your kids into it.
And, like, I had a friend growing up whose parents got divorced, and the dad, like, tried to get his ex-wife Baker acted,
mm-hmm.
and literally hired someone to kill her.
Yeah.
And, like, all this stuff, and guess what? Now his kids haven't seen him in 10 years because they're like, I don't want to see you. You did all these shitty things to our mom who, like, has taken care of us and been nothing but loving to us, and you've just been a piece of shit.
Yeah. Like, just, it's, I don't know. As much as you hate them, it's, like, not your kids' fault in any way, shape, or form, so fucking leave them out of it, exactly. Basically. So, some more primo Betty moments include in, like, the... Because this divorce takes place over, like, 4 years. Yeah. So, there's just a ton of crazy shit that happens. At one point, she drove her car through the front door of Dan's new home after he sold their other family home out from under Betty without her knowing. She was obviously pissed about him selling the home, even though he had already bought her a new house to live in, which was a $650,000 house. I think it was, like, the principle of the matter, that it was their family home, you know? After she smashed into his house, Dan tried to pull her out of the car, and she reached under the seat and pulled out a butcher's knife. When police showed up, she was taken away in a straitjacket and held in a mental hospital for 3 days. She also one time, I don't know why, but this one really gets me.
Yeah, it's great.
She also smeared a Boston cream pie all over his clothes when she came into his house one day unannounced, and then also spray painted the walls and broke his windows and mirrors. Mostly the Boston cream pie part was funny to me, not the, like, vandalism.
Yeah, because
I know that's, like, technically vandalism, but it's funny vandalism.
And you can clean it.
Yeah. She also defaced court documents by writing God wherever Dan's name was. She would cross it out and write God. And then she also broke into the house another time by throwing wine bottles through a window, smashed their sliding glass door, and it destroyed their new toaster, which, God forbid. Right. They have so much money, I'm sure they could afford 20 new toasters.
I know, I'm like, a toaster is like $20.
He was just like, because she was making his life a living hell, he was like, I'm going to be petty and, like, take you to court for that new toaster, mm-hmm. basically. Over the years of the divorce, Betty's behavior grew increasingly violent and erratic. Dan, being a lawyer, knew how to keep a cooler head in these situations and would just repeatedly haul Betty into court for violating her restraining order. And after one of these hearings, Betty was held in jail for, like, 3 days on a 3-day hold. Mm-hmm. A lot of onlookers thought that Dan was egging Betty on instead of trying to help her when she was clearly going through something, which is 100% true.
Yeah. Like, she needed mental health at this help at this point.
Because, like, her whole life has been taken away from her. And, like, at the start of their relationship, you wanted to marry her and no one else. And now, like, there's a 20-year-old that you want to marry instead. And that's probably, like, really fucking devastating, it truthfully.
Is. And, like, this new Linda lady basically looked like Betty, but, like 20 young Betty. Years younger. Yeah. Yeah, so she just felt like she was getting replaced. So, throughout this divorce time, Betty was receiving $9,000 a month in alimony and would later increase to $16,000 a month.
Yep.
Like, I live on $2,100 a month. But Betty was still hopeful that one day her husband would just return home and, mm-hmm. like, love her again.
Yeah.
And Betty also believed that $16,000 a month was not enough for her to maintain her socialite lifestyle, and at one point said, I had nothing left to live on. But Dan, this part is my favorite thing Dan has ever done in his life. Dan would just take away small payments from mm-hmm. this $16,000 a month.
I think that's why she says she has nothing left probably. To live on.
And he would do this, like, and cite her with these fines. And he would do, like, $100 for every curse word that she used, $250 every time she stepped foot on his property, $500 every time she entered his home, and $1,000 every time she took one of the children without his permission. One time, he had to charge her so much because she was so shitty in a month that her alimony was negative $1,300. That's $16,000 worth of infringements.
Mm-hmm.
And as we all know, Betty loved leaving those nasty voicemails. And one time she was in the middle of leaving one, and their 11-year-old son, Danny, picks up the phone and says, "You guys are separated, Mom, and he likes somebody else now. He doesn't like you anymore. And you gotta stop saying the bad words." So Betty says, "Why doesn't he like me anymore?" Danny says, "He's sick of you because you get in all these fights." Betty says, "Why do we get in all these fights?"
I don't think she's talking like that.
No, she is. Yeah.
Oh,
like, listening
okay.
to the messages. And Danny says, "I don't know." And Betty says, "Because he was fucking his secretary, Danny." Or because he was fucking his secretary. Danny says, "Even before that, you got into fights, Mom." Betty said, "I don't think so, Danny. See, you didn't know he was fucking his secretary for the last years that we were married." Danny said, "We want to live with you, but you're making it harder for all of us to live over there. If you stop saying bad words, everyone will be happier. At least I know I will." And, like, he's, like, crying this whole time, and she's just being a cunt.
Mm-hmm.
And there is another part of the conversation that mm-hmm. there's an actual recording of, so if we want to put that here.
"Scum, Danny. He's absolute scum. He has cheated and lied and f***ed around. There's nothing..."
"Don't you think being mad for 2 years is enough, though, Mom?"
"We're the best family in the whole world. We were all so happy. All the kids and me were so happy.
I know, but we're going to be a lot happier if you just stop saying bad words."
"Will you tell that slime ball..."
"See what I mean, Mom? You're saying it right now. You better stop."
And just another example of how terrible Betty is. That she also was pretty shitty to her kids as well. And just an example was when Kim was 18, she discovered that she was pregnant. And instead of going to Betty, she went to Linda for help in getting an abortion. And when Betty found out, she wrote letters and called all of Kim's friends and family and all of Dan's family to tell them that she had gotten an abortion. And Kim said that she thinks her mom did this to punish her since she went to Linda for help instead of her, because Betty was being a hypocrite because she had had an abortion before the two boys were born. So she was like, "She's just mad at me, so she's telling all of my friends and family this secret personal thing about me."
Mm-hmm.
But Betty did say that Dan and Linda were equally terrible to her, saying that she would receive ads for weight loss pills and samples of skincare, thinking that Linda was sending them to her. And Betty was even sent a photo of Dan and Linda with the caption, "Eat your heart out, bitch," because Betty had gained some weight since the divorce. Linda also refused to give Betty back her wedding china after Betty asked for it back, which is just like a low blow, you know?
Yeah. The divorce was finalized 4 years later in 1989, and a lot of people believe that Dan did this on purpose. In California, there is not a very well-known legal concept called Epstein credits, and these would thwart any financial settlement that was entitled to Betty. By the time the trial ended because of these credits, Betty's share of community property was substantially reduced. In fact, the judge ruled that she owed Dan $750,000 in Epstein's in cash advances, all of which had been accrued between the time he had moved out and the date the divorce was final. Dan was ordered to pay his wife less than $30,000 in cash. He was also re-awarded custody of the children, and Betty received no formal visitation rights. Obviously, Betty was feeling even more devastated than before. Sometime in March 1989, Betty bought a Smith & Wesson revolver, claiming she needed it for protection now that she was living alone as a single lady. She took shooting lessons and carried the gun with her most of the time. According to some accounts, she also threatened to shoot Dan with it. Despite Betty, Dan and Linda had a happy relationship, and friends said that Linda brought out the softer side of Dan. And in June of 1988, the couple got engaged. On April 22, 1989, only 10 days after what would have been Dan and Betty's 20th anniversary, Dan and Linda were married, and their wedding was in the front yard of their mansion. See, I think it's little things like this that Dan does the entire time just to piss off Betty.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not saying he deserved to be murdered in any way, shape, or form, because no one deserves to be murdered, but, like, he was just trying to make her feel fucking crazy and feel alone and feel sad, you know? And that's super fucked up. On their wedding day, Linda was so worried about Betty showing up that she told Dan that she wanted him to wear a bulletproof vest under his suit. He did not, but he did hire undercover security guards in case she showed up. The wedding went through without any interruptions, as one of Betty's friends stayed with her that day and made sure she didn't leave the home. But Betty refused to change her last name and kept calling herself Mrs. Broderick. 4 days before Betty's 42nd birthday, on the first Friday in November of 1989, another round of legal papers showed up at her door. Dan was threatening to file criminal contempt charges unless she stopped leaving lewd messages on his answering machine. She would call Dan and Linda obscene names, like calling Linda the office whore and a cunt. Betty later said that she was exhausted by these constant court battles and compared them to putting a housewife in the ring with Muhammad Ali, which is incredibly true, like, in terms of legality.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, he did drag it out 4 years later so he wouldn't have to pay her shit. And, mm-hmm. like, he did a bunch of shit just to break her,
yeah,
because, like, she was annoying him.
It's, you like, know? He did all of these psychological things where she did all of these, like, acting out things.
Yeah, and, like, from the outside looking in, it looks insane, but, like, that's probably the only thing she knew how to do because she couldn't get to him psychologically, you yeah. know? Which is the whole, like, that's the whole argument with this yeah. case, essentially.
That's the whole game that he was playing.
Yeah.
And, like, you can't see him psychologically breaking her down, but you yeah. can see the crazy outbursts that she does, like, driving her car through his house.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, doing things like, 10 days after our 20th anniversary, let's get fucking married, yeah. you know? And, like, 4 days before her birthday, let's send her some new legal documents. Like, it's specifically shit like that that, like, you know he's planning it yeah. out just to be an asshole. And it's like, bruh, why? You already won. You have the big mansion. You have the hot wife. You have your kids. Leave your fucking ex-wife alone. You're also obsessed. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
It's just, they're both terrible.
They're both, like, just, they, yeah, didn't know how to handle it.
So, 7 months after Dan and Linda's wedding, on November 5th, 1989, Betty drove to her ex-husband's home in Martson Hills, in the Martson Hills neighborhood in San Diego, at around 5 a.m. She entered the home while everyone was sleeping and had used a key that she had stolen from her daughter, Lee. She then went up to Dan and Linda's bedroom and shot them both around 5:30 a.m. with her .38 caliber 5-shot revolver. Two bullets struck Linda in the head and chest, which killed her instantly, and Linda was only 28 years old. One bullet hit Dan in the chest while he was reaching for the phone, and the bullet fractured a rib and tore through his right lung. He died a few minutes after being shot, and he was 44 and just 17 days away from being 45. And then this was also 2 days after Betty's birthday. And it came out later that after she shot Dan, he had said, okay, you got me. Then she noticed the phone next to him, so she ripped the cord out of the wall so he couldn't call and left him to die. She said in an interview, he was on the floor and the phone was right next to him. I thought, oh my God, he's going to be on that phone before I'm down the stairs, before she pulled out the phone cord. And there were two more shots fired, but one hit the wall and another one hit the nightstand. After the murder, she called her daughter Lee and Lee's boyfriend and told them that she shot a gun in their bedroom, but didn't think that they were dead because Dan was talking. She then arrived at Lee's house and called her eldest daughter, Kim, and she told Kim that she couldn't live on like this and that she didn't have a choice anymore. It was either going to be her or him that died. Later that day, she turned herself into the police. She never denied killing the couple, but she did say that she originally entered the home because she wanted to confront them and then planned on killing herself in front of them. Betty said later on Oprah that she got to the bedroom and the door was slightly open. When she pushed open the door, Linda woke up and screamed, "Call the police." Betty said that she then saw Dan reaching for the phone, and this startled her, so she screamed, "No," and the gun just went off. And then it happened so fast. After shooting both Dan and Linda, she had no bullets left for herself.
This killing shocked the community, but also became a symbol of rage and revenge amongst divorced couples. At a cocktail party soon after the murder, a man was overheard saying, "I guess this is be nice to the ex-wife week." But to women, they saw themselves in Betty, saying that she was a woman who refused to be broken by her husband despite his attempts. After a newspaper piece was run on Betty, hundreds of people began writing to her in local newspapers saying they didn't want to condone violence but understood why she had done it. One woman wrote, "I believe every word Betty says, because I've been there. Lawyers and judges simply refuse to protect mothers against this type of legalized emotional terrorism." In an interview with the LA Times just 3 weeks after the murders, Betty said that if Dan had settled the divorce to her liking, "I would have been fine. I would have had my house, my kids, I would have still worn a size 6, I could have done my superior dance." She had also talked about all the things that Dan did to drive her crazy, saying, "I never had emotional disturbance or mental illness, except when he provoked a disturbance. My emotional outbursts were only a response to Dan's calculating, hateful way of dealing with our divorce. He was hammering into me and everyone else that I was crazy. How long can you live like that?"
So, during the first trial, Betty's attorney was Jack Early. His defense was that Betty had been a battered wife who was driven over the edge by the years of emotional, verbal, and psychological abuse by Dan. The prosecutor, Carrie Wells, claimed that Betty was not a battered woman, but portrayed her as a murderer who schemed to kill her ex-husband. And psychologist Dr. Park Dietz testified that Betty had histrionic and narcissistic personality disorders. And during the time of the murder, Betty actually had a boyfriend who she'd been seeing for a while, and she actually got to have Danny and Rhett stay with her a few nights a week, kind of as like a test trial to have her get custody back. Mm-hmm. So her life was starting to look up, but she couldn't stop obsessing over Dan and Linda. And Danny and Rhett were actually at Betty's house the night that she killed Dan and Linda, so like at least they weren't at the house. And at this time, the older daughters were over 18 and had moved out already.
Mm-hmm.
After the murder, the two sons were put into the care of Dan's sister-in-law. The first trial ended with a hung jury, when two of the jurors said that there was no intent to murder, and they wanted to charge her with manslaughter instead of second-degree murder. So the judge declared it as a mistrial in November of 1990. The second trial began a year later, and was essentially a replay of the first trial with the same defense attorney and prosecutor. In this trial, the jury found Betty guilty of 2 counts of second-degree murder. Betty was sentenced to 2 consecutive terms of 15 years to life for each murder, plus an additional 2 years for an illegal use of a firearm, and she was sentenced in December of 1991. And in between the two trials, a videotape from jail came about showing Betty going crazy, and they believe it was, like, after a fight. And when she was put in isolation, she took her feces and smeared it all over the walls. And so, like, she still wasn't, like, she obviously needed help and wasn't getting the help that she needed.
Yeah, it sounds like she had some type of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
In 1992, Betty and her children, Kim and Danny, separately did interviews with Oprah. In Betty's interview, Betty acts super manic. She's trying to defend herself, but does so by yelling and not letting Oprah get in a single word. During this interview, Oprah does get the chance to ask her if she was sorry about everything, to which Betty replied, "I'm sorry about this whole thing, but I'm mostly sorry that Dan Broderick chose to conduct our marriage and his family and his life the way he did. There was no reason for it, and it was brutality, and we didn't deserve that." In Kim and Danny's interview, Kim says that she believes her mother deliberately killed Dan and Linda. Danny said that she would often threaten to kill his father, but never believed that she would go through with it. At one point, Oprah asked Danny if he thought his mother was mentally stable through the divorce and murders, and he said yes, and Kim just looked at him like, "What are you talking about, bitch?"
Yeah, she was just like, what?
Betty has been in jail at the California Institution for Women since the day she committed the murders and is there for 32 years to life. Since then, she has been denied parole 3 times, in January of 2010, November of 2011, and in January of 2017. She was denied because the parole board says that she does not show remorse or recognize any wrongdoing. One parole commissioner said, "Your heart is still bitter and you are still angry." After being denied parole in 2017, Betty wrote, "I have met all criteria for parole and my release date was 2010. Now I am only a political prisoner. They have no reason to deny my parole." Her next parole review is 2032, but she may be eligible for an earlier hearing if she meets the requirements and shows good behavior, but she's now 72 years old. Like, I actually, like, Betty has me up until she buys the Smith & Wesson, because I do think at that time she made the decision to kill her, like, her ex-husband. Yeah, you know, but, like, up until then, I'm just like, I get it. You're going through a really shitty divorce and, like, you feel crazy. I get it.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, I get the, like, calling and leaving the voicemails and destroying the clothes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, like, driving your car through his house is extreme, because you don't know if your kids were right there next to the front door and she could have killed them or whatever.
Yeah, no, definitely.
And also, something that was, like, really big on the prosecution was that they said, since the fact that she pulled out the, like, phone cord so they couldn't call for help, that mm-hmm. it was, like, that's why they went for second-degree murder and right. not just manslaughter, because that shows intent to mm-hmm. kill them.
Yeah. I think as soon as she bought the gun, she had an intent to kill them. It doesn't have any doubt in my mind that that was not her intention when she went there with that yeah. Smith & Wesson.
It's like, especially with the kids saying that she threatened all the time.
Yeah.
And on the Oprah interview, she asked, like, "You didn't have to bring the gun there. Why did you bring the gun there?"
Mm-hmm.
And Betty said that she brought the gun there in order to make them listen to her, because every time she went there, they just called the cops, and if she had the gun,
yeah,
then they wouldn't be able to call the cops and they would actually have to listen to what she had to say.
Yeah. I mean, that also, like, not bringing a gun, I'm saying, like, that mentality yeah. screams, "I just want you to fucking listen to me."
Yeah. And, like, Oprah was like, "Yeah, but you really didn't have to bring the gun." Like,
yeah, for sure. I think, like, it was just, like, own up to the affair, my guy. Like, before you move out of the house, just be like, I think the cruelty that was done with is what, like, broke her almost. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because, like, having someone leave you for, like, a lady who's 21 is pretty fucking shitty already. Yeah. And then just being like, also, I know you know, but I've been lying. But we hope that you guys liked this episode. This is a controversial one.
Yeah, so give us everyone your has
their different opinions on it. So give us your thoughts in the reviews when you leave us a 5-star review.
Exactly. On Apple Podcasts.
Yeah.
And also remember to check us out on Crime Binge on Twitter and Crime Binge Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. We also have our website, which is just crimebinge.com. And when you go there, you can check out our cute little submission page button thing and submit your stories and ideas.
Yeah. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.